All right. Hey, I am Slash. I'm a guitar player. And
And you're in my apartment in Stockholm.
Yes, so. It's nice.
Welcome. You're about to release Orgy of the Damned, a record where you and the star-studded lineup interpret blues classics. How much has the blues meant to you?
The blues is really the foundation of everything that I do, you know, as a musician. But it was my first real favorite type of music when I was really little. And I was raised around a lot of British rock and roll in England, and I moved to the States, and then my grandmother turned me on to B.B. King and a bunch of other stuff. And I really remember that very, you know, like it stuck with me. So I'd say the blues is real important to who I am.
The cover of the album is a painting by the comic book artist Tony Grease. Mm. It's a painting about a lot of people dancing in a club, and it really reminded me of Marvin Gaye's album I Want You, where he put this painting called The Sugar Shack by Ernie Barnes.
I'm not sure. Oh, yeah. I didn't know that was on the Marvin. That's right. It was. I remember it from Good Times. Oh. There was a TV show, a sitcom called Good Times with J.J. Walker. And anyway.
So that was a deliberate reference, not to Marvin Gaye, but to the other painting.
Yeah, because what happened was the Ernie Barnes idea came to mind. Obviously, I wasn't going to try and get that. So I really liked Tony. I had an idea in my mind of something based on that. And I called Tony Grease up and said, okay, so I've got this idea. And we sort of went back and forth and came up with this.
I read somewhere that Eddie Murphy bought the original Sugar Shack painting.
It what?
Eddie Murphy, who bought the original.
Oh, that's what I heard. Yeah, yeah. I heard that too, yeah.
One of the first things that he did was his money.
Yeah, which is really, really cool, you know.
How did you come up with the title, Orgy of the Damned? Well, you know, it made me think of Anne Rice and her vampire books.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people sort of have this horror reference, which I do a lot of horror stuff, so I understand that. But Orgy of the Damned came because I had this idea how blues music was always told to the, you know, said to be devil's music and taboo and don't let the kids listen to it and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I thought if you get all these musicians together to do a collaboration on blues music, it's Orgy of the Damned, right? So this next song is Killing Floor by Howlin' Wolf.
It's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And you've got Brian Johnson from AC/DC singing on this track. And his voice is so much darker than it usually is.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, you know, when I called Brian about this song, he got really excited because Howlin' Wolf was a big influence on him. And we didn't know that. I just, when I heard, when I thought, who would sing Killing Floor? Brian was the first guy that came to mind. So, I talked to Brian about it. He gave me all this background on blues music that he listened to when he was younger. And I was realizing, you know, we all know Brian from AC/DC. We don't know any of his background. Anyway, but I've been friends with him for a long time. And he was very excited to do it. And when we went in the studio to cut the track, he wanted to do it in the range that Howlin' Wolf did it. You know, going into the higher range would sort of eliminate that whole sort of vibe. So he did it in the range that Howlin' Wolf did it.
And in the lyrics, Howlin' Wolf kind of uses the floor of a slaughterhouse as a metaphor for being in a miserable relationship. Yeah. I read up on this track, and apparently, according to some blues historians, Howlin' Wolf was inspired to write that song after one of his lady friends found a pair of panties in his tour bus. And she was so upset that she shot him with buckshot. In the back, it took them a week to remove all the buckshot from his behind.
I did not know that.
Supposedly.
Supposedly, yes. Look at that.
I wouldn't be here tonight. Down on the killing floor. God knows.
The first time you heard AC/DC, or the first show you went to by your own, was on the Back in Black tour, right?
Yeah, that was the first AC/DC, not the first show that I ever went to, but the first AC/DC show that I ever went to.
What kind of impression did that leave on you?
That's a good question. Well, okay, AC/DC at that point was already one of my favorite bands from when Bon Scott was in it. So when Back in Black came out, I remember the first time I ever listened to it, I was at Seymour Cassell's house, who's an actor. Like, actually, the guy that gave me the name Slash. I was at Seymour Cassell's house. I listened to that record, and it was fucking amazing. It was such a great... I think 1980 was just a great year for music because a lot of great records came out at that time, iconic records. Anyway, and so I went and saw them at the Long Beach Arena, and it was great. I mean, it was one of those sort of rock and roll revelation things where you really know that rock and roll is alive and well, you know? It was good.
Speaking of your nickname, where did he find Slash? Because that sounds like a horror reference as well. You know, slasher movie.
I never know why he called me that back then. But years later, I was on the road with Guns N' Roses and I ran into Seymour in, I think it was in Belgium. And we went to lunch one day, and I asked him, why did you always used to call me Slash? You know, because it's obviously a nickname that stuck. And he goes, because you were always hustling. You're always in a hurry. You never stop to talk. You're always, you know, either coming or going, you know? And so it's like, there goes Slash, you know? and I was like, okay, that's that, you know?
Speaking of horror, I actually tried to Google Orgy of the Damned on a porn site.
On a porn site?
Yes, and I found this erotic vampire movie called Orgy of the Damned.
Because I Googled it too. It must be the same movie. I didn't know it was.
It's a very like soft core pornography.
I didn't know the porn reference, but yeah, it was like from earlier in the 2020 or 2019 or something like
yes.
that.
Yes.
All right. I looked it up. I figured I could get away with using the title for the record.
You were born in the UK and you moved to LA with your parents when you were five.
Six.
Did you experience some kind of culture shock? Because the UK to me feels so greyish in the 70s.
Well, I mean, and also it was in the Midlands, you know, Stoke-on-Trent, so it's up there. But I loved England, you know, so I loved Stoke because I was young enough to really appreciate being in a small community. You know, there's one church and two schools and the street where all the shops were and all my family was around. So I loved it there, but I sort of, and then my dad would, he and I would take the train into London because my dad was more of a, he was an artist and that's where all everything was happening, you know, it was in London. So I enjoyed going to London and stuff. When I moved to the States, it, you know, at that age, it was more exciting than it was a real culture shock, you know. It was huge, obviously, much more spread out than Stoke was. And there was, you know, in Stoke, we listened to a lot of music, a lot of rock and roll. And when I moved to the States, there was even more music because we were, both my parents at that point were both in the music business and there was just music everywhere and musicians everywhere. And it was great. I really enjoyed it. But I did miss England.
And eventually you ended up in Laurel Canyon for a couple of years.
That was really
the epicenter of 70s rock music.
Yeah, that's where it started. That's where I moved to. So my mom stayed in LA and I was living in England. So the plan was always to bring me over. But they waited till I got older. Anyway, so my mom had a house in Laurel Canyon. And
she made clothes for artists,
yeah.
Like I think she all worked kinds of people, she worked yeah. on Joni Mitchell's wardrobe, and your father designed her album covers.
Yeah, yeah, and actually, and did a lot of stuff for David Geffen when he started Asylum Records. You know, so but I was there was a lot of really great music around, and you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash were up there. Jackson Browne was up there. There was just a lot of obscure artists that probably never became really famous, but they were around at the time. You know, spent a lot of time at the Troubadour. You know, that kind of thing. So it was a good environment.
A boy's born in hard-time Mississippi, surrounded by for world that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city.
Yeah, so this next song is one of my all-time favorite Stevie Wonder songs, Living for the City.
And you can bet he barely makes a dollar. His mother goes to scrub the floors for many, and you best believe she hardly gets a penny. Living just enough for the city. Yeah.
Om du tyckte om den här podden så kanske du vill stötta Hemma hos Drage via Patreon. Den som gör det får nya avsnitt 2 dagar tidigare än andra. Den som gör det slipper också reklam och får en hel del Lacho-erbjudanden plus ett signerat ex av min bok Text. Den som gör det får också ibland den hemliga litterära minipodden Reading Rocks där jag läser högt ur rockjournalistiska mästerverk. Så gå in på www.patreon.com/hemmahosdrage och anmäl dig där om du vill bli en kulturmecenat som främjar Sveriges främsta musikpodd. He's also one of the few artists that you cover on this album who's still alive.
Mm. I didn't think about that, but yeah, that's true.
Of course, Tash Neal sings on this one.
Yeah.
And was he one of the artists that you would meet when you were growing up?
No, who?
Stevie Wonder.
No,
did your mother
My mom, you know, like this record, Inner Visions, I think it was. My mom loves Stevie Wonder. So she played, I remember, Songs in the Key of Life, Inner Visions, all the Stevie Wonder stuff being in around the house at that time. This was after my mom and dad split up. So that she could listen to what she wanted to all day long. It didn't matter. Anyway, and so I remember loving the song. I didn't meet Stevie until years and years later. We met... God, I can't remember exactly where it was we first met, but we've run into each other a few times, and he's a sweetheart. He's great, and one of my musical heroes. You know,
I remember when I was in my teens, I didn't really start listening to your music until I saw this picture of you because I was into electronic music. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it was a picture of you wearing a skinny puppy t-shirt. And I was like, wow, that's unexpected. I need to check out this more.
Oh, that's funny.
So did you listen to them or did you just get the t-shirt?
To be totally honest, I was not really familiar with Skinny Puppy, but back in the day, I used to just get my clothes from wherever I could get them, wherever I woke up, you know? And that just that just happened to be someone's t-shirt that she loaned me.
Okay, so it was some girlfriend's t-shirt.
Yeah.
Well,
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees.
This is Crossroad Blues by Robert Johnson.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees. Had a lot of bourbon mercy. Say, poor Bob, if you please.
So according to blues mythology, Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil to become the greatest guitar player of all time. Did you sell your soul as well, or did you just practice a lot?
You know what? You do have to practice a lot, but you actually do make a lot of sacrifices in order to do this to the extent that it needs to be done in order to do anything with it. And I don't know if it's selling your soul to the devil, but it's definitely giving up as much as you possibly can, you know. It's hard to explain that one, but it's like everything goes if you're gonna do this, you know.
One of my favorite YouTube videos is when you play with Michael Jackson. I think it's in Seoul in South Korea. Mm-hmm. You're on a tour together called MJ and Friends. Yeah. So you're one of his friends. And you won't stop soloing. You just keep going. And it's quite obviously like pre-planned, but it's super funny.
Well, it was pre-planned to an extent. Michael told me at the end of the song, just, you know, because I would do that anyway. I would just play and just keep playing if you didn't stop me. So he goes, just do that. Just keep playing. If anybody tries to stop you, just play through it. Don't fucking stop. And I was like, okay. And that's what I did. And then all of a sudden, these goons came after me. And I was like, okay.
So that was not planned.
That wasn't really planned. No, Michael planned it. I didn't know what was going on.
And that concert took place on I think, the 25th of June, 1999, exactly 10 years before he died.
Mm. Yeah, that wasn't the last time I played with him, though. The last time I played with him was, September 10th, 2001. Right in New York,
oh,
the night
you were
before
at that concert
9/11, yeah.
Oh.
So it was crazy. It was two shows at the Madison Square Garden, the one on the 8th and one on the 10th. And it was myself and all these other friends of Michael's that are celebrities all getting up on stage. I mean, it was huge, sold out, massive thing. And then the morning after the final show, I get this phone call from Michael's guitar player, David, and he goes, are you watching the news? I said, no, the TV's on, but the news was. I put it on, and the first plane it hit. And the second one hit just as I was watching the TV, and I was in Midtown Manhattan. So that was that, and that's one of the reasons why nobody knows about those two shows. Because
I remember people being upset with the huge billboards with a picture of Michael Jackson saying Invincible, that were all over New York at that time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, someone...
I wasn't really aware of that. But
That was the album title, right? Invincible.
The one that I was on?
No, you weren't Dangerous.
The ones afterwards, yeah.
But you recorded the track Given to Me on the Dangerous album. Mm,
yeah.
And that's about as close as it got to some kind of hard rock, if you don't count Dirty Diana. But what was it like to work in a studio? You know, I imagine that it was a bit more controlled than what you were used to.
No, actually, it was cool. I mean, I met Michael at the studio. It was at the record plant in Los Angeles. And that was the first time he and I met. He had called me and asked me to do this. And so I met him at the studio, and he goes, just do whatever you want, Slash, you know. And that was it. And he was with Brooke Shields at the time, so I'll never forget that. Because, I remember Brooke from Blue Lagoon or whatever. Anyway, so they took off.
They were dating?
I don't know what they were doing, but they went to dinner. and left me in the studio with Bill Petrell, who was the engineer, and they had the song, and I just put the guitars on there, and they gave me total autonomy, and I just did my thing. And that was it. It was really a cool session as far as just being able to just be myself and not having anybody try and direct me or anything. All right, this is Awful Dream by Lightning Hopkins.
Have you ever looked over a mountain? One you ain't never seen. Have you ever looked over a mountain? A mountain you've never seen.
And of course Iggy Pop sings on this track.
Yeah, there's an interesting story to this one. When I was doing this record, I picked all the songs and then figured out I wanted to sing on each one. And while I was in the process of doing that, my bass player Johnny Gruperic, who's actually from here, Stockholm, he goes, I heard Iggy Pop has always wanted to do a blues project, and he's just never done it. And so I thought, you know, at that point in time, I thought, that's really interesting. And so I decided to act on it, and I called Iggy and asked him about it. And he goes, yeah, man, I've just never, you know, I've always wanted to do a blues project, but I just never had the opportunity. So I said, I'm doing this record of like sort of old R&B and blues songs. If you had to pick a song to sing, a blues track, what would it be? And he automatically said Awful Dream by Lightning Hopkins. Didn't think twice. So I knew it meant something to him. So I went and listened to this version of it. And I thought, okay. So we set a date for a week for him to fly into LA and meet me at my studio. And we just sat on a couple stools. And I played the guitar, and he just sang the fucking great version of this song. And it was really a moment. It was a really cool moment.
And he would imitate an harmonica, right?
Yeah, well, it was only one take. And so I was sitting playing my guitar, and I have my eyes closed. And I hear this sound, and I'm looking around, and I lift my head up, and there he is miming the harmonica with his mouth and his hands. It was great.
And Iggy, of course, worked on your solo album, and you worked on his album Brick by Brick, yeah, which came out in 1990.
Yeah.
Those recordings were supposedly quite chaotic.
Oh, they were fun.
They were fun.
Okay. Yeah, they were definitely fun.
Look like it's gonna rain. Yeah, the little bird was singing, they were singing. It looked like it was gonna rain.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Speaking of people who knew Iggy Pop well, what was it like when your mother brought home her new boyfriend who turned out to be David Bowie?
That was an interesting time. It was actually roughly around the same time that we were listening to all the Stevie Wonder, because it was like 1975, 1976.
Because your mom worked on, she made costumes for The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah, well, she did that, and she also did his whole sort of Thin White Duke period with the suits. That was her thing. The black suits.
So she
suits.
Actually created that?
She designed the suits. And she did a suit for the Grammys when he went to the Grammys. So they started dating. And, you know, David was cool, you know.
I
was roughly 10 and 11. And
was the Station to Station era.
Yeah. And actually, one of the most memorable concerts that I ever went to was that going to see the show for that record. And he had this great introduction, which I think the way that he came out was actually the song that, I forgot what it's called. But anyway, it was this amazing sort of reveal that went into the show that went on like for 5 minutes with this sickler sound that rotated around the room. It was great.
It was at the Forum, right?
It was at the Forum, yeah.
I remember seeing that they showed that old surrealist movie, Beyond the Lucian Dog.
Yeah.
Before he went on.
Yeah.
Some kind of intro.
Yeah.
But did you meet Iggy as well at that time?
He was friends
with Bowie.
No, that was how I first met Iggy. Iggy actually sort of, I told him about this. He doesn't really remember it, but he was incapacitated at the time.
You mentioned in your book that your mom and Bowie went to pay a visit to Iggy when he was in a psych ward.
Yeah, he was in a thing. And I didn't actually physically meet him, but that's how I first became aware of Iggy. So he and I had a couple good laughs about that.
But he doesn't remember that much from...
He remembers my mom. But he doesn't remember... He didn't meet me, like I said, in person.
You know I smoked a lot of grass. Oh Lord, I popped a lot of pills. But I've never touched nothing that my spirit could kill.
This is The Pusher by Steppenwolf.
People walking around with tombstones in their eyes. If you live or if you die.
And who sings this track on?
It's Tony Kaye.
On the version.
No, I'm sorry.
On your version.
And it's not Tony Kaye either. What's his name? It's Chris Robinson singing
from the Black
version
Crows.
From Black Crows. Oh. Yeah. And really, really good version of the song.
The Steppenwolf's version was on the Easy Rider soundtrack.
Yes, it was. It
became a huge hit. It was written by country music artist and sometimes actor Hoyt Axton.
Hoyt Axton, yeah,
who
yeah,
was
yeah.
In, he played the father in Gremlins.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird.
No, he was a pretty popular actor back in the day, Hoyt Axton. But it's a great song. And when I was a kid, right around when I first got to the U.S., I think that Steppenwolf was really the counterculture poster boy. You know, they all their songs were really statements about the what was going on at that time, and it was really cool. They had a big impact on me.
How much does this song about a pusher man remind you of your more self-destructive days?
It's a more peaceful, more innocent song than my more destructive days, you know, because it's all about, you know, just smoke a little grass and then all the other bad stuff.
Because he kind of, he differentiates between the dealer who gives you the good grass and the pusher, and the who's a monster.
Who's selling you the smack and the coke and the uppers and all that.
I remember, weirdly enough, that Blind Melon, the band Blind Melon, covered this song right before Shannon Hoon died.
Shannon, I remember Shannon very well. I never saw them play it, but I knew that he loved that song.
Is it true that your mom made you talk to David Bowie when you were kind of strung out?
Well, she gave me his number, is what it was.
So it wasn't like an intervention?
No.
So you called him
after
many years of not speaking to him.
Yeah, no, well, you know, he and I actually had run into each other. Him and my mom came to a Guns N' Roses show at a club in L.A.
Wow.
And so I'd seen him. I hadn't seen him in a long time prior to that. But anyway, we sort of reacquainted. And then, you know, I was going through some particularly confusing chemically induced breakdown.
In what way?
And I thought,
see things?
Yeah, I had a lot of hallucinations at that time. Anyway, so I asked my mom how to get in touch with David, and she gave me his number, and I called David, and David gave me some not necessarily what you call advice. It was basically just acknowledging what I was going through and what I had opened myself up to, and that it wasn't necessarily the best place to be. And I was like, okay.
So what kind of hallucinations did you have?
Oh, they were, I had these little men that was the biggest one. They would appear after I did my big shot. They would sort of just come around. They had
like midgets?
Little guys like about that big.
Even tiny, like elves?
Dozens of them. Oh. Yeah. And they were violent.
I think that Bowie had the same kind of talk with Trent Reznor.
Yeah.
When they met in the mid-90s, he you know, because they worked together, and he told Trent Reznor, you know, there's a different way to do things.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have to do
this. You can get into a really dark place, and it's hard to get out of it, you know. And I know Trent had a similar experience.
This summer, you're taking this blues project on the road?
For
the Serpent Festival, and the letters in Serpent stand for Solidarity, Engagement, Restore Peace, Equality, and Tolerance.
Yeah.
And you've described this festival as a celebration of unity and togetherness in these uncertain and divisive times. Do you worry a lot about the state of the world?
I don't really mix politics with music. I don't advocate anything. You know, I don't get into big conversations about my opinions about politics or who's in them. But I do recognize that there has been a real divisive period that's been going on specifically from 2020 up till now, and it's really getting, the chasm is getting wider and wider. And so I wanted to do something where it was about bringing people together of all ethnicities, of all, you know, genders, and really welcome people no matter who you are and what your differences are, and try and have a really great time just spending an entire day together with music. And I don't know, so I just feel like I wanted to do something positive.
So you created the Serpent Festival, and as most people know, you're a huge fan of serpents and snakes.
Yeah.
Do you still have any at home?
No, I only have one snake, and he's at the zoo in Nashville.
Okay.
Because I just don't have anybody that can watch him for me at home. So.
What's his name?
Sam.
Sam. And how many snakes did you have?
I had upwards of 100 snakes prior to that. Up until I had my first son. And when he was just about to be born, I got cold feet, and I thought, this is probably a disaster waiting to happen with all these massive snakes all over the house. So I gave everything away. And then London was born. And then Sam was given to me on my birthday when London was probably about 5 years old. And so I kept Sam and raised him since he was just a little guy then. He's an anaconda, so he was a baby. But now he's like 15 feet long.
Snakes have a tendency to disappear when you have them at home.
It happens. Yeah. Yeah. Snakes are amazing escape artists. Yeah.
But how did that fascination start from?
You know, ever since I was a little kid, I loved reptiles. I loved animals in general, but I had a real fascination with reptiles, and especially snakes and dinosaurs and art and scary movies and all that stuff. I haven't really changed much.
I have a few questions from my listeners, and not just any listeners, but the brave souls who support this podcast through Patreon. And the first question is from Peter D. How many Gibson Les Pauls from 1959 do you own?
I have, I think, six. Off the top of my head, I think six. Six 59s.
Here's one from Jonas Agerbjörn. Getting a bit older, I expect that you, like many of your peers, for example, Eddie Vedder, have started wearing on-stage shoes that are supportive of knees and back. But honestly, if you could go back to playing a warm-up show at the Whiskey in 1990, would you wear Vans or Converse?
I would still wear Converse. I love Vans, but I'd probably still wear Converse.
Is they're more comfortable?
I think I always just thought Converse were sort of more rock and roll than Vans were.
And finally, one from Nils Seder. Many Bob Dylan fans considered the song Wiggle Wiggle from 1990 to be the worst song he ever recorded. You play guitar on it. Did you feel like saying, Mr. Dylan, I'm sorry, but this doesn't really work? Or were you too polite to open your mouth?
Well, I mean, getting a phone call from Bob Dylan to go play on a record was something that I, you know, would probably never in a million years have expected. In the actual song itself, I couldn't really, I didn't think it was a great song either, you know.
It's like a children's rhyme.
Then I did the guitars on it, and I put a really cool solo on it, and they took it off. And they just left me playing the acoustic in the background. And I asked why, and he goes, well, it sounded like too much like Guns N' Roses. And I was like, why'd you call me that? What the fuck? Anyway, it was a great learning experience. It was something that I'll never forget the whole way it came together. So
you were more
is
free?
That Streets of Fire?
It sure is.
No way.
Do you like that movie?
I just was hanging out with Lee Ving the other day, and he's in it.
That's my favorite rock and roll soundtrack. Those two songs
you just took me all the way back to like 1980. Was it 1983 or something?
84, I think.
Yeah.
But I love Jim Steinman.
Yeah.
And those two songs, Nowhere Fast and Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young, are like my favorite songs of all time, I think.
They're, that was the first Willem Dafoe movie that I ever
saw. And he looks so cool in those rubber pants or. Michael Paré.
Tremendous crush on what's her face,
Diane Lane.
Yes, from that period.
Well, so did I. So you know, if I see that soundtrack, I'll buy it. I have like 10 copies.
Yeah, right. You're like me. I would do the same thing.
Yeah. God, I love Streets of Fire. Let's listen to Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young. That's my favorite song of all time, I think. Written by Jim Steinman.
The beach and the perfect waves are starting to come. His hair is flying out in ribbons of gold, and his touch, he's got the power to stun. I got a dream about an angel in the forest, and jammed by the edge of a lake. Body's glowing in the jewels of light, and the air below him starting to shake.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I reread your book this week.
You did? Wow.
One excellent story is how you go to the Rainbow, which would become your standard hangout, but you go there when you're like 16 or 17 and they won't let you in. And you get really upset because your friend is inside. So you go home.
It was Steve Adler.
Okay.
Yeah, it was with Steve Adler.
And so you go home and what happened?
So they wouldn't let me in. I got busted on. I mean, I did his fake ID and he got let in and I got busted on mine. I've been going in there for a year at least with the same fake ID. So I went home and I just sat there and I was bored. And then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go. It's ladies' night. So I went in my mom's closet. She wasn't home. Went in my mom's closet, dressed myself up, and then got in the car, my mom's car, drove back up to the Rainbow, parked like a block and a half away, and walked down to the Rainbow. And I totally was like going to go in there and pick up on Steve. And it was going to be really funny because Steve would fuck anything. So anyway, and so I got in, right? And then I went around the Rainbow and realized he's not there. He's already picked some chick up and he's disappeared. And all of a sudden, it was like all the color and all the fucking light just went away. And everything was just black and doom. And I was like in the Rainbow in fucking girl's clothes by myself. And I was like, fuck. And I have to get out of here. And it was the longest walk back to the car that, and people were honking and whistling and I didn't know if it was at me and it was just like really vulnerable fucking feeling.
So the only time you went out in drag, but you've never felt like a need to like explore a more feminine aesthetic on stage, because a lot of bands in the 80s that would hang out at the Rainbow looked, you know, very feminine.
Yeah, no.
That was never your cup of tea.
No, I mean, there was a period there where there was a little bit of experimentation going on with a little makeup and a little like fishnet this or whatever. Very sort of 80s, but not in the fashion that like, say, Poison or those guys were doing it. A little bit of a sort of androgynous kind of a thing, but it didn't last for very long.
Maybe. You looked more like Hanoi Rocks.
Well, I think that was more of the
those guys sort looked of, like that, they would stab you.
New York Dolls, Hanoi Rocks kind of influence, Lou Reed.
Oh, finally, here's a question from Lasse Nivier. I missed this one. I understand that you're interested in dinosaurs. There are differing opinions on whether the flying reptile Quetzalcoatlus could actually fly.
Quetzalcoatlus, yeah.
Yes, what's your opinion?
It's a, you know what it is? It's a massive,
huge dinosaur bird.
Yeah, bird, yeah. They've shown proof of how it could have flown. It's hard to believe, but they seem to be able to support the theory that they could fly. So I'm like, you know, I suppose if the theory really physically works mathematically or however they come to that decision, you know, then that conclusion, then I guess maybe it's possible. There would be no other point for a bird that size with those wings to just sit around on the ground.
I was watching this interview where you had a lot of dinosaurs, tiny dinosaurs in the background on your bookshelves.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You don't collect like dinosaur skeletons?
No,
like
I would never buy authentic skeletons. I think they should be in museums. So I sort of look down on people who buy fossils and put them in their houses.
and you don't collect snakes anymore. Is that because you think about animal rights as well?
It's a combination of things. For one, I'm really too busy to give the attention that they need, and I've also gotten to the point in my life where I can't sacrifice mammals to snakes anymore. I just don't feel comfortable doing that. And they're like, "We'll feed them dead food," but I feel like, you know, snakes need live food to have the exercise that they need, because sitting around in someone's home enclosure, it doesn't really afford them that much exercise. So they actually look forward to their feeding time to be able to move around. And I don't feel right about putting an animal who's got no choice in the matter, you know, in that situation. So yeah, I guess with old age, I've sort of gotten soft. I used to do it, and I've always cared about the animals that I was feeding them. So it was always hard, but, you know, I think over time I just got to the point where theoretically, I feel like it's just wrong, you know. Well, yeah, it's been great talking to you. I have to get out of here. I have a long day in front of me, but I've really enjoyed being here.
Well, thank you for coming here to discuss blues and snakes. So yeah. Slither on, or whatever you say.
Thank you, Slash. Cheers.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Lejon Media. Slash var hemma hos Drage. Woohoo!